Thanks again for the invitation, and thank you for changing the time to accommodate my awkward Australian time zone. Yes, I will talk about bipedal entanglement in the era of time, and this will be based on two papers. I will also reference another more recent one with Eric Calacanti, who I'm currently working with. The first one here is with Andrea Stirring, who with whom I as you just said, like there's two problems that I will try to address in this talk. We're focusing on trying to reconstruct the bipartite quantum state space, and the second one actually has the title of the talk, and we'll focus on one key physical ingredient that we'll try to argue for that it's important to do such a reconstruction, and how that can actually be used to get some insight into entanglement. So let me see if I can. Yeah, okay, perfect. So here's the sketch of my talk, which I hope will last roughly 45 minutes, and then I look forward to the discussion afterwards. So yeah, there's these two problems that I want to address. The first being trying to reconstruct the quantum state space in the bipartite case. And that has been attempted before by different people, and the usual starting point is the null signaling principle. So I'll also do that. I will review the principle and then build on that to sketch a solution of how one can actually recover the bipartite quantum state space. And then in the second part, I will focus on one ingredient that I will need in my reconstruction, which I call here preserving time orientations. And also I'll introduce or at least motivate this notion of a time orientation. And so using a consistency condition with respect to this notion, I will find that one can actually characterize the space of separable bipartite states within the full bipartite state space, quantum state space. And this is related and might, at least after the first half of the talk, remind of the Paris-Hordesky criterion. In fact, there is a fairly clear connection, so I'll try to sketch that and motivate it in the sense. And then sort of by improving the criterion, by sharpening it in a certain way, I'll prove the claim.
Marcus, we mm-hmm. still see only your title slide. I think you're probably on an
Yeah, I'll edit here for maybe just a few seconds then. So this is the outline of my talk. There's these two problems that I want to address. And okay, so let me start with the first one. So the characterization of the bipartite quantum state space. And yeah, just as a brief introduction, talking about bipartite correlations in general, in particular, starting with the classical ones, that we are familiar with and that are most intuitive to us. So these are usually interpreted or at least formalized in terms of classical probability space, and then they arise as measures on this space. So usually in classical physics, one would take this to be phase space of some sort. And there's a nice sort of way of constraining such correlations, which Pitalski reviews and actually goes all the way back to Boole, which he calls conditions of possible experience. So there's a way sort of to put constraints on what correlations can arise in this way, what correlations can be reconstructed from in this formalism, so effectively from an underlying Boolean algebra. Well, as we know, since Bell, classical correlations are not exhaustive of all quantum correlations. There's quantum correlations that go beyond some of those constraints. And an obvious problem that in quantum information and set here informally is to find what differentiates quantum from classical correlations. And in particular, in this context that I want to review here in the bipartite case, people have looked at it in this sort of vein. So trying to find physical criteria that reconstruct the quantum state space, starting with this principle of null signaling, which I will review in the next slide. Since that is not sufficient to constrain the quantum state space or quantum correlations, one has to come up with a different criterion. Here's just a few examples that people have considered, information causality being maybe one of the more well-known ones. There's a whole bunch. I'm not trying to review all of them here. Popescu reviews different ones in this paper. The point that I want to make here is that, as far as I know, they are not conclusive. So in particular, these almost quantum correlations by Navaskis et al. Satisfy most, if not all, of these criteria and are not quantum. So this leaves the problem of classifying the private quantum state space, at least in some, to some extent, open. So this is what I will attempt here, and I will sort of follow a similar vein, also starting with no-signaling. So let me start with the no-signaling principle.
Just to check in, are you trying to reconstruct like the set of quantum states or the set of quantum correlations?
Yeah, that's a good point. No, I'll reconstruct the quantum state space, not just the correlations.
Okay,
so let me fix some notation. So I will use this notation, and maybe also as a sort of warning, depending on the audience, this talk might come across as slightly more mathematical than others. I hope I can convince you that these are useful techniques and I can make contact to the physics. But yeah, so this is the notation I will use. I'll use mu AB, uppercase AB, lowercase AB, and the conditions to denote a joint probability distribution for observables, lowercase AB, and uppercase AB standing here for the outcomes of those observables. I'm not specifying a particular theory at this moment, or I don't need to. And what's called a behavior often is then a collection of such joint probability distributions indexed by some set of observables. So the principle that Bell suggests as a criterion on or as a constraint on such correlations or behaviors is the one of relativistic causality, which you're all familiar with. So the idea is that given some common cause, these correlations should factorize into just the marginalized distributions on the respective local for the respective local parties. And the crucial insight is that quantum theory doesn't satisfy this principle. It's violated, and the only sort of weakened form that survives is this no-signaling principle, which is that if one marginalizes over the outcomes of one observable, say on Bob's side here, then independent of what observable Bob chooses to measure it, and on his side, the marginalized distribution on Alice's side is always the same, then that's a symmetric constraint. So this principle is satisfied in quantum theory, however, it's not distinctive for it. The space of no-signaling distributions or correlations is a lot larger than the space of even quantum correlations, as was shown by Popescu and Rohrlich, for instance. So the task is then really like what further constraints can we put to get back to quantum states. And one rather obvious thing to do is to restrict to quantum theory, at least locally. So again, here on this slide, I haven't really specified in what an observable, so observable is here theory independent in a way. The idea is to fix these observables to be given by quantum theory locally. So what does that mean? The idea is that we just fix the algebras of observables, the self-adjoint operators or Hermitian operators, for both Alice and Bob to be given by quantum theory. And in fact, this has been considered before, and there's a nice result that gets us quite far, in fact. Namely, if we fix the Silbert space dimensions of Alice and Bob systems to be at least three-dimensional, then there's one-to-one correspondence between non-signaling behaviors indexed by their respective Hermitian observables and operators on the bipartite system on the tensor product algebra that are normalized and that also satisfy this condition here. So that if you evaluate them with respect to tensor products of local operators, then the Born rule is always yields positive probabilities, like it yields probabilities. So this condition is sometimes known as POPT for positive on pure tensors, which is just precisely this condition, or sometimes it's also called block positive. So I'll refer to these operators here since they are reminiscent and like, satisfy a weaker condition than density matrices as POPT states or these block positive states. And yeah, in terms of correlations, it's interesting that one can show, at least in the bipartite case, that these PT correlations are in fact no stronger than quantum correlations. This is a nice result by Barnum et al. Who show that you can show a nice transformation that establishes you can always simulate PWT correlations in the Babelstadt case using a quantum state. However, this only works in the Babelstadt case, as was shown in this paper, and there's ways to even test such correlations in the Babelstadt case that indicate that they're not quantum. So this is really not a satisfactory result. One really would want these states here to be density matrices. So rather than this sort of weakened positivity condition, one wants them to actually be positive. So that's the task that one has in trying to reconstruct the quantum state space. Okay, so in order to get there, this is sort of the sketch of the first part of the talk. I'll also restrict to locally quantum observables and the signaling constraint that, according to this result that I just showed you, leads to POPT states. I will reformulate this signaling constraint into what's sometimes called the no disturbance condition. And in fact, this will be equivalent to this condition in this case, because it's in fact intrinsic in the assumption of locally quantum observables. And then I will try to strengthen this condition. Yep.
Sorry, what is a locally quantum observable?
Yeah, locally quantum just means that I assume the space of observables of both systems to be restricted to Hermitian operators locally. So there's no the only operators that I put constraints for are tensor products of operators A and B.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then I will first reformulate this condition to this no disturbance condition. Then I will do two things. I will first strengthen this condition to what I call no disturbance for dilations. And interestingly, that gets us very close to quantum states, but not quite. And in fact, that indicates this necessary additional structure that I call time orientations. And that will actually get us to quantum states. So that's the outline for the first part. Okay, and let me get into this in a bit more detail. So what we actually assuming there's no signaling constraint is a form of no disturbance, and the idea and together with the assumption that we have quantum observables locally, there's an additional structure that is present, which is that of a co-measurable subset, so this co-measurability structure. So what does that mean? I will formulate this in a particular language which you might or might not have seen. So it's, language of contextuality, going back to Isham and Dering, and that we've also reviewed in this context in this paper. So I will call the context category, and denoted by this curly V of H, as the collection of all commutative subalgebras of the algebra of observables, or just the quantum algebra here. And a commutative subalgebra then corresponds to a context. And the idea is just that co-measurability in quantum theory is given by commutativity. If two observables are commutative, then we can measure them simultaneously. So this object here will really just be a kind of bookkeeping device of all the contexts, and in that sense, all co-measurable observables. But also the way how they are included. So for certain coarse-grained contexts, so not maximal contexts, i.e. not maximal commutative subalgebras, might lie, as in might be included in certain maximal ones, and these inclusion relations will encode non-contextuality conditions. So how does that look in a bit more detail? So the no disturbance condition in this context, the no disturbance condition in this formalism takes this form, that if we have three such contexts, i.e. three such commutative subalgebras, where one of them is included in two larger ones, then assigning each of them a probability distribution mu, then restricting these distributions from the larger to the smaller context has to be independent on which larger context I picked. And here the restriction of these distributions just means marginalization. So if I marginalize from different maximal contexts, then I get the same marginalized distribution in the smaller context. This is the way that this object here keeps track of these non-contextuality conditions. And in fact, taking the system to be not a bipartite or multipartite system, but just a single system, this is precisely the type of condition that allows us to infer that a set of distributions, a set of probability distributions over the quantum observables corresponds to a quantum state. So Gleason's theorem assumes precisely these conditions. So how does this have to do with node signaling? Well, if we are now in the context, if we're now in the situation of two parties, then these contexts always have this sort of product form. So I have two objects like this, namely one for Alice and one for Bob. Contexts always have this product form, and the restrictions here, the marginalization constraints, I can look at them on Alice's and on Bob's side and have this non-contextuality condition that the marginalized context is independent of which larger context the distribution comes from. And while the non-signaling constraint has this form, just where I restrict one of these contexts to be the trivial or minimal context where I don't measure anything, or the only observable that I consider is the one that just observes that there is a system, if you like. So meaning that if I marginalize to this observable, then I get the same marginalized distribution. So in this sense, the non-signaling condition is just a particular type of no disturbance condition. And the fact really is that because we have assumed locally quantum observables already in this result that I showed you in the beginning, assuming this no disturbance condition is really no difference. It's just making it more explicit. That's what's been there all along. In fact, what Clay et al. And Valak use in their reconstruction to show that such distributions or behaviors always correspond to POPT states is roughly speaking to apply Gleason's theorem sort of on both sides, both Alice's and Bob's sides. So it's really the no disturbance condition that also goes in Gleason's theorem that does the job. And well, comparing it to Gleason's theorem then, which does get us to quantum states for a single system, it is kind of clear that just this condition is not sufficient. Now we need something stronger. And in order to get there, in order to strengthen this condition, I want to reformulate now the set of constraints that we have on distributions. And this will have to do with Nymax theorem. So bear with me. This is a bit technical maybe, but so the idea is that if we have, if we look at this set of distributions, and we look at it from the perspective of one context, say on Alice's side, then what we really have is a measure on the projections of P of VA or P of HB. Here stands for the projections of the respective inputs here. So the projections of the context VA or the projections of the whole Hilbert space PB. So it's a map from those projections into the unit interval. So in this can be equivalently seen as a positive operator valued measure, which is not normalized. Namely, in the following sense, that I can also think of it as a map from the projections in this context to a positive operator on Bob's side via this equation. So in this step, I effectively apply Gleason's theorem on Bob's side to show that Bob's both part of the correlation is given by a positive operator. So to get back to the results by Clay et al, what one has is that these POVMs that are dependent on the context analysis side are in fact context independent and lift to a map from Alice's algebra to Bob's algebra. So what's happening here is really that I'm sort of doing the usual trick of going from a state to a map. So in particular, I'm using the Choi-Jung-Minkowski isomorphism. So reformulating the problem via the Choi-Jung-Minkowski isomorphism, what we had to start with was that we had a bipartite POPT state, which under the Choi-Jung-Minkowski isomorphism corresponds to a positive map here. Whereas what we really want to, or what we have in the quantum case, is that we have a positive state, which under the Choi-Jung-Minkowski corresponds to a completely positive map. So equivalently to trying to lift this POPT condition to positivity, we can also look at what lifts positive maps to completely positive maps. And this is actually how I'll get there in in the end. So, well, taking this perspective, there's the following theorem, which suggests the strengthening of the no disturbance condition, as I showed you a few slides ago, namely Nanmax theorem, which tells us that given a POVM, such as this one, there always exists a larger Hilbert space KB, a linear map from the Hilbert space on Bob's side to this larger Hilbert space KB, and a projection value measure that reduces to the POVM in this way. And the idea now is that, well, in context at least, maybe we can assume that all the POVMs do arise from PVMs in this way. And in fact, this allows them to strengthen the non-contextuality conditions that I have on the context here on Alice's side to these PVMs. So making this precise is a bit of a cumbersome definition, but that's really what's happening in this. So sorry that it looks so cumbersome, but this is really just implementing what I just said. So given a behavior that satisfy given a behavior, it satisfies no disturbance violations if writing it now in this form that I showed you on the previous slide, namely just writing it in terms of these POVMs indexed by the context analysis side, then I say it satisfies no disturbance violations if there exists such a larger Hilbert space and linear map into this larger Hilbert space and projection valued measures for every context for now, but such that now the distribution that I get on this larger Hilbert space in fact satisfies the no disturbance principle also for all the projections in this larger space, also with respect to these sort of non-marginalized observables or projections that Bob has. So in terms of the physics, what's happening here is really that, like, again, in context anyway, one interprets these distributions dependent on context analysis side as a state of incomplete information in the usual way. So yeah, the idea is that such a distribution arises via coarse graining of some ancillary degrees of freedom on Bob's side in this case. And yeah, the other thing that I want to stress is that this is really just a no disturbance condition. So I mean, after saying all these things, it's just that this satisfies the no disturbance principle, which is just a non-contextuality condition. And the point is now that this strengthened condition actually allows for a stronger version of Gleason's theorem to be applied, which goes back to Bunce and Wright, and leads to the following intermediate results. Namely that if we do assume a behavior in dimension at least three for both sides, which again, this condition is just to do with Gleason's theorem in the canonical form applying to dimension three only. So yeah, if we have such a behavior and it satisfies no disturbance for violations, then this behavior in fact corresponds to a state or by the Charge and Minkowski, it's a map that has this form. So roughly speaking, these PVMs lift to a map large phi here, which has this nice property that it's a Jordan homomorphism. And a map small phi of this form, which between a linear map being a Jordan homomorphism is also called a decomposable map. So we've gotten further than before. I will just show you how far we actually have gotten, but if you're not familiar with Jordan homomorphisms, here's just or Jordan algebras, here's just a very brief review. And I mean, here I will not look at the general structure of these algebras, but really just the ones that come from quantum theory. So the Jordan algebra of observables in particular that I will be dealing with here is the one that is given by all the self-adjoint or Hermitian operators on our quantum system. But rather than looking at the usual operator product, so multiplication of matrices, the product that I'm considering is the symmetrized product here, or also the anticommutator. So the algebra that one gets by looking at this structure is a Jordan algebra. It's a particular type of Jordan algebra, but that doesn't concern us here. And the Jordan homomorphism is just the map that preserves this anticommutator. So it just satisfies this condition here. Okay, so what does it mean that we have a decomposable map now? What does it actually tell us? Well, this form might not look very familiar to you, but in fact, there's a characterization of completely positive maps that has precisely this form, but with large phi being a slightly different type of map, namely Steinspring's theorem. So this works in the full generality of C-star algebras, even though everything is five-dimensional. But yeah, given a C-star algebra A and a map from A into the bounded operators in some Hilbert space, then this map is completely positive if and only if there exists a Steinspring dilation. So it's the same ingredients as before. We have a Hilbert space K, a linear map from H to K, and a map large phi here, which is now a C-star homomorphism. And again, the completely positive map has this form that's wedged between this linear map. It dilates to a C-star homomorphism. So comparing these two structures then, so Jordan homomorphism again preserves anticommutators. As the star homomorphism preserves the operator products, and we can always decompose the operator products into the anti-commutator and the commutator. So the difference then between, hope you don't see this somehow. I can put those there. Okay. The difference between the two then is the commutator. So a Jordan homomorphism lifts a C-star homomorphism, which is what we want, because we actually want it a completely positive map, if and only if it also preserves commutators. So this is a bit of a formal criterion, but there's a nice physical interpretation to it again, because commutators infinitesimally encode the dynamics of our system. And in fact, this can be made very precise also formally. And this is sort of the last step in this reconstruction, which I called preserving time orientation. So the background is that people have studied Jordan and C-star algebras in full generality from a mathematics perspective, and in particular, Austin and Schulz found that given a Jordan algebra, it lifts, i.e. it corresponds or it arises from the self-adjoint operators of a C-star algebra if and only if the Jordan algebra admits a map of this type here. And this, so that holds in general, but here we have this very particular case of the Jordan algebra being given by the observables and the anticommutator, and our quantum our C-star algebra just being the matrix algebra on some Hilbert space. So in this particular case, the type of map always has this form. So we have a real parameter, or it's indexed by a real parameter and an element in the Jordan algebra, and it maps into an automorphism on the Jordan algebra of this form, namely that if the plus minus indicates that there's exactly two types of these maps in this particular case. So given this parameter T and A, evaluating it, so this being the automorphism, evaluating it on some element in the algebra, it's just given by conjugation of this form. And this is reminiscent of the dynamics in a quantum system. So in particular, one would like to interpret the parameter T here with as a time parameter and A as a Hamiltonian of the system. So to have a picture in mind, this is sort of what it looks like in the simple case of a two-dimensional system and in the Bloch sphere. So in this particular case, these two time orientations, the two maps that one finds, two maps of the time that one finds in this case, are distinguished by the orientation, that is by the way the system flows around the axis of rotation, which is given by, in this case, the eigenvalues of the of A, i.e. the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian. So lifting a Jordan algebra again to a C-star algebra has to do with such a map existing. So the idea now is that since we already have a decomposable map which lifts to which corresponds to preserving the Jordan algebra, we also wanted to, in order to lift that to a completely positive map, we wanted to preserve this extra structure, so to preserve this time orientation.
Marcus, ask for like a brief check-in, because I feel like I'm getting a bit lost. You started by saying that there are these states that are positive on tensor products, and they're not satisfying, because although such states, these entanglement witnesses, in the bipartite case, they would cover all quantum correlations, one problem is that it doesn't work if you try to go to the tripartite case. But even if we ignore the tripartite case, it's just not the set of quantum states.
Yeah.
And then it seems to me that what you're doing here is you're still staying in the bipartite situation. So you're not saying, let's go fix the problems in the tripartite states. You're saying the real problem that's motivating you is it's just not the correct quantum states. If all we require is positivity on its product. So then when you change from no signaling to no disturbance, I'm not really sure what the motivation there was. And it sounds to me like you're building to some sort of replacement for, instead of positivity on tensor products, you want to sort of say something about the dilation and positivity with respect to the dilation of a tensor product, or can you sort of like just tell me sort of where we're going with this so I can know where we're looking?
Yeah, okay. So as an overview again, so the no disturbance is really just making precise what it, so there was two things that went into this first result, which already told us that behaviors on the bipartite system correspond to TOPT states. In particular, that's already quite a lot of structure, right? Because we already have the linear structure of the Hilbert space. It's just the positivity condition that's missing. So to get to that step, one implicitly assumes this non-contextuality or no disturbance condition. It's just not very explicit in the theorem as it's formulated, because it says no signaling on locally quantum observables. So in reformulating it in terms of no disturbance, I'm just making precise that this is a structure that's implicit in assuming the observables to be locally quantum. That was the first part. And then, because that is precisely the structure that allows us to infer that behaviors correspond to quantum states on a single system according to Gleason's theorem, this property by itself cannot be sufficient. There needs to be something else. And then, yes, the idea is now to, because formally the only difference is the sort of notion of positivity, like POPT being a weakened notion of positivity, if you like. So I'm effectively trying to reconstruct this positivity condition, but in a way faithful to this idea that we have this sort of context structure. So I'm trying to first strengthen this condition of no disturbance to dilated systems. And this result that I just showed you here with, this one is interesting in the sense that it gets us close to quantum. So right now I'm just trying to review like what's the difference really. So I assuming the stronger version of no disturbance gets us to something that, yeah, again, like I've also shifted perspective from sort of states to maps. But in this picture, I'm now very close to completely positive maps, which corresponds to positivity via the Chojin-Minkowski isomorphism. Namely, I have these decomposable maps, and these have to do with this like Jordan structure. So right now I'm just trying to give a bit of background and then motivate this extra condition one needs to get from this Jordan structure to C star structure, which is what would get us complete positivity and therefore positivity on the level of states. Yeah, it's thanks. A bunch of steps. I will review the steps in the final arguments. I hope it becomes clear then. There's a few steps involved, yeah. Okay. So these maps in what I call time orientations, they just encode the commutator really, because if we differentiate in the usual fashion, then one sees that this is just the commutator. So preserving these time orientations preserves the commutator. And on the previous slide, I showed you that the operator product is just the commutator and the anti-commutator. Jordan homomorphisms already preserve the anti-commutator, yes. So preserving time orientations encodes preserving commutators and therefore preserves the whole operator product. So Jordan homomorphism then is a C-star homomorphism, i.e. preserves the operator product if and only if it preserves the time orientations. So the final ingredient then is what I call preserving time orientations, which is just this condition, namely that if I have such a behavior, I say preserves time orientations if this dilated map that the state corresponds to, according to the theorem that I showed you before, this Jordan homomorphism behaves nicely with respect to the time orientations that I fix on Alice's and Bob's side, which for now is a choice. I haven't specified that to start with, but if it's possible to specify them in this way, then I say that it preserves time orientations. Okay, so this is where I review all the ingredients again and the state the final result of this first part. So namely, if I have Hilbert spaces of dimension at least 3 on both sides again, for Alice and Bob, and I have a behavior of this form, which preserves time orientations and therefore in particular satisfies the stronger version of no disturbance, then it corresponds to a quantum state. So the steps in the proof. So here's everything in a condensed fashion. So satisfying no disturbance by, excuse me, satisfying no disturbance according to this first result I showed you means that the correlation really corresponds to a POPT state. And under the Choi-Jeong-Minkowski isomorphism, that's equivalent to saying that the corresponding map is positive. Satisfying no disturbance for dilations, that was this intermediate result I showed you, gives us extra structure on this type of map, on this positive map. Namely, it has this form where this large phi map here is a Jordan homomorphism. So in other words, this map here is decomposable. And preserving time orientations means that, in fact, this map here is not just a Jordan homomorphism, but a C-star homomorphism. And then by Steinstein's theorem, I know that the map is then, in fact, completely positive. And going back via the Choi-Jeong-Minkowski isomorphism tells us that the state that this map corresponds to is, in fact, positive. So that's the chain of reasoning here. Okay, so to show you the schematic again, this is sort of the solution that I'm proposing here. So I'm just staying true to these non-contextuality constraints. I've strengthened this no disturbance principle and then found that, in fact, one needs something slightly more. One needs this preservation of time orientations to get to quantum states. Okay. The second part, I want to focus on this, on this last ingredient here, on these time orientations, which I think is an interesting insight taken from the first part. And I want to delve deeper into what this structure really encodes in terms of the correlations in terms of the states. So in particular, the question I will be asking is, what happens if a state is preserves time orientation, i.e. is compatible with different time orientations. So in other words, is oblivious to the choice of time orientations in the respective systems. And as I said, this will have to do with the Paris-Hodetsky criterion. So I will I'll review that also. So just as a fixed notation here, I've already used the Choi-Jeong-Minkowski isomorphism quite a bit between operators on a tensor product system and maps between the two algebras. And choice theorem was the one that I used that establishes that positivity on the level of states corresponds to complete positivity on the level of maps. But then in order to focus on the difference that these time orientations play, what I really want is to relax this condition slightly. I want to, rather than complete positivity, I want to look at these decomposable maps. And again, under the Choi-Jeong-Minkowski isomorphism, I can look at the class of operators, class of type of density operators, i.e. states, on this side of the isomorphism that corresponds to these decomposable maps. So I will call these LD or SD. And just as a reference here, with Eric, I go into more detail about the Choi-Jeong-Minkowski isomorphism, notions of positivity in it, and the distinction between Jordan and C-star structure, but that shouldn't concern us here. This is just for notation. I will denote by SDAB here the space of normalized operators that corresponds to decomposable maps. Okay, so focusing just on this part, so in some sense fixing the Jordan structure to start with, which was part of the reconstruction in the first part, I can draw a different picture that just says the same thing, distills part of the result I showed you in the first part, namely that observables being locally quantum, and as I showed you, that really just encoding the Jordan algebra part. If we assumed no disturbance for dilations, then we got to a state space that is just faithful to the structure, namely to states that encode this Jordan structure, so corresponding to decomposable maps. And fixing these time orientations, which I told you is exactly what one needs in order to go from Jordan algebra to Sitala algebra has allowed us to go to the quantum state space. So the first result distilled to or fixing the Jordan structure already can be reformulated in this way. So if we already know that our state is in this space, so corresponds to the decomposable map, then it is quantum if and only if it's time oriented. Okay, so the problem that I want to look at now is that, well, on the quantum state space obviously includes all the separable states. So can we somehow from this class of state, from of larger this larger class of states, and not just quantum states, but all those that correspond to decomposable maps, can we find a criterion that singles out the separable state space? So that's the problem. Okay, and the idea will be that, well, like how do these states play with different notions of time orientations, different types of maps here that I introduced before. And yeah, this is reminiscent of the Paris Hodes criterion, or might be if you're familiar with it. And in fact, this idea that the Paris Hodes criterion has to do with time reversal symmetry has been around for a while. I've seen it in even the early papers by the Horodetskys, but I haven't seen it made precise. So this part of the talk is really just making this sort of conceptual side, as in like the relation with time precise. It's not improving on the practicality of the criterion, I should say. Okay, so let me review the criterion just briefly. So given a separable Thagatide state, Paris notes that it always has a positive partial transpose. So taking transpose on this Alice's side, say, then one still obtains a quantum state. So then the Horodetskys showed that this is if and only if, only in very low dimensions. So usually this criterion is not if and only if. Okay, so because I've looked at everything under the Troyer-Minkowski isomorphism, I will also have to look at this criterion under the Troyer-Minkowski isomorphism. So let's just fix this very explicitly now, namely, which I guess goes by Troyer isomorphism rather than Troyer-Minkowski. So then it looks like this. So given an operator on the tensor product system, then I can translate back and forth between that and a map in this usual fashion. So this is me fixing the isomorphism explicitly. And then the following lemma holds. This is namely that if I have such an operator, then the corresponding map always has a Stein spring dilation because it's completely positive. Yeah, exactly. So S is the state space. So this is actually a density matrix. So then this map is always completely positive. So it has a Stein spring dilation. So then the following holds, namely that if I take the partial transpose of this operator and then look at the corresponding map on the Troyer-Minkowski isomorphism, then that's just the Hermitian adjoint here. I write star instead of dagger. I should probably write dagger. But yeah, so then it's just this map or viewed in terms of its Stein spring dilation. This dagger just ends up on the C-star homomorphism in the middle. And this is just the one liner, which we don't have to get into, but it's just interesting to notice that, this criterion has this nice form under the Troyer-Minkowski isomorphism. So the first thing I want to point out here trying to differentiate here the Jordan and C-star structure is that if we try to formulate this criterion on the level of decomposable maps, then it's actually empty. So it's trivial, it doesn't say anything. And there's the following result, that namely, if I start with a state that's in this larger class of states, namely those corresponding to decomposable maps, then taking the partial transpose, I just end up in the same state space. So that's different in the quantum case, right? So there it's only true for or it's in particular true for separable states, but it's not true for all entangled states. And the argument is straightforward, namely that again, this notation was just to say that the corresponding map is decomposable, so it has this form where phi is now a Jordan homomorphism. And the point now is that under the PPT criterion, that was just taking the Hermitian adjoint of this map, but that is also a Jordan homomorphism because the end of the day, what the star does, what the dagger does, is it changes the order of these two operators. But because I only look at the at the symmetrized product, so at the anti-commutator, changing order doesn't matter, and I still end up with a anti-commutator preserving map, so with a Jordan homomorphism. So that just means that the state is again in the state space. So that's again indicative of the of what I was saying before, namely that it is precisely the time orientations that are sensitive to the Paris Hodges criterion. Okay, so the idea now to bring this home is, so what happens if we look at a change in time orientations and compatibility of the state under such a change? So keeping with the Paris Hodges criterion, I can strengthen it in the following way, namely that, okay, again, starting with a state and its corresponding map and the Steinspring orientation, Steinspring dilation for such a map, then here's what that what the criterion translates to on the level of these maps. Namely, having a positive partial transpose means that this map here is completely positive, meaning that, as I showed you in this lemma, this map Hermitian dagger is completely positive, which by Steinspring's theorem means there exists some dilation also for this map of this form. But because I already have a Steinspring dilation of the original map, it makes sense to relate these two. And I ask the following stronger condition, namely, when is this map here, so taking the adjoint directly here, also a Steinspring dilation for this map? Okay, and the technical result that one gets is this one, namely that if I have a state, it's corresponding to Minkowski and a Steinspring dilation, then it's separable if and only if also this here is a Steinspring dilation. So said differently, if and only if the Hermitian adjoint of this map is also a C-star homomorphism. Okay, that's a bit of a technical result, but reformulating it now in terms of these time orientations, I get the following, namely that given a state in this ladder class of states, it's separable if and only if it's time orientated with respect to both choices of time orientations on either algebra. So for as an example, I take the algebra, the C-star algebra corresponding to one choice of time orientation on Alice's system and some choice of time orientation on Bob's system, as well as a different choice of time orientation on Alice's side and the same choice of time orientation for Bob's side. So the argument is then just this, that one part of the if and only if is that, well, if I have a separable state, then by the theorem on the last page, both of these maps here are C-star homomorphisms. And that was just the definition of it being time oriented with respect to both of these algebras. The other direction being the more interesting ones, if the state is time oriented with respect to both of these C-star algebras, then these conditions here and that I formulated earlier hold. And if I differentiate both of them, then what I get is that this here holds, meaning that the image under this map commutes. So in other words, this map here maps into a commutative subalgebra, and that is actually the same condition as both of these maps being C-star algebra homomorphisms. So by the previous theorem, that means that the state is separable. So it's only a bit technical, but the overall result I think is quite nice and has this has a physical meaning to it, namely that really this choice of time orientation is precisely what encodes separability. So yeah, let me just summarize now using this picture, both of the results that I wanted talked about in this talk. So the first problem was the classification of quantum states. I started with fixing the structure of observables to be locally quantum, and what that really meant is locally Jordan algebras to start with, and encoding the non-contextuality conditions on this level led to PFPT states. Strengthening into dilations led to states corresponding to decomposable maps, and also enforcing a preservation a consistency condition with respect to time orientations led us to quantum states. So that was the first result. I already showed you this halfway through the talk. And the second problem was trying to classify the separable state space within the quantum state space. And here, the result is that, in fact, a set is separable if and only if it's time oriented with respect to both choices. So said differently, if it's ambiguous with respect to how you choose these time orientations in the local system. So how you lift the Jordan algebra to a sister algebra. Okay, so yeah, this is in a nutshell. So I need these three constraints, fixing the observables to be locally quantum, no disturbance for dilations and preservation of time orientations, and the classification of separable states was this invariance condition on the change of time orientation. So I think the key insight of this really is that entanglement is related to this intrinsic, and in fact, it's a relative notion of time orientation that I need. And yeah, I just leave you with some ideas I have and where I would like this to go beyond these results, namely towards the classification of entanglement or separability more generally. So a first step in this direction I've taken with Eric recently, where we analyze this notion in the Churchill-Minkowski isomorphism, which is obviously a very important tool in quantum information altogether. And well, going beyond this Bagdad case, one would like to generalize it to infinite dimensions, which I haven't done in this paper with Andreas, but well, here we at least generalize the result that I showed you in the first part of the talk to infinite dimensions and arbitrary phenomenal algebras. So it is suggested that this can be done. And obviously one would also lift this constraint on just looking at Bagdad correlations. And yeah, I think there's a number of interesting applications that one can consider, and one might want to study this notion of time orientation in namely quantum causal models, which I might just state here that the conditions one puts on so-called process operators are all the trace conditions, and since the trace is symmetric, it really also just sees the Jordan structure. So again, I think careful distinction between these two properties, and therefore time orientations might be a useful study in this context. People have studied quantum Bayes' theorem and this notion of quantum states over time, and Arthur Parsignat and James Fullwood have shown that such states over time actually exist, and in a particular form which also uses this Jordan structure, which is quite interesting, I think. And yeah, there's several ideas trying to link entanglement with time and in space time even. Maybe this can be useful in this context too. But yeah, this is all speculative. Okay, so with this, I leave you here, and thank you very much for your attention. If you have any questions for the references, let me know, I can show you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. That was great.
Thank you.
So because we're in a Zoom session, I would ask people to raise their hands if they have a question, and we'll take them. I see Robert, you had your question up pretty quickly.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, very interesting talk, I thought. I'm wondering, though, it's all about bipartite entanglement. So is it possible that tripartite entanglement can shed any more light on time orientation or something of that nature or not?
So yeah, this is work I wanted to, I haven't done yet, but I think what happens is that one has further consistency conditions between how one can choose these time orientations in different systems. So right now I have almost no constraint. I just have this for a state to be a quantum state, it needs to be time oriented with respect between the two local algebras. But if one has a tripartite or more generally multipartite state, looking at different bipartitions, one would have this condition between all possible bipartitions, and that would force consistency constraints between the choices of time orientations with respect to these different bipartitions, I think.
That's what I would have guessed as well.
Yeah.
So turning it around then, suppose I want to come up with some crazy theory, maybe based on what I believe gravity does, where there is not a consistent time orientation, that some local systems have one direction, some have the other. What's going to give? I mean, is this doable at all?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think that, I mean, Jordan algebras have almost exactly the same structure as C algebras, and you can, I mean, most sort of technical tools one uses in C algebra theory already hold in on the level of Jordan algebras, and the so in that sense, one could attempt to formulate a theory that just like looks at Jordan algebras and then completely neglects this extra structure, which has to do with time orientations. But yeah, because there's all these consistency conditions, and I think what that means effectively is that like when systems have interacted and we have some knowledge about fixing a state on a multipartite systems, that's sort of the other way, looking at the result the other way around, right? Like having knowing or given a state, I already fix sort of a relative time orientation between the systems. So such a generalization to just the Jordan structure would in some sense mean that I'm speculating here, but would in some sense mean that I haven't fixed this time orientation to start with. So in some sense, the interaction between the systems, my knowledge about the systems has to be restricted to like allowing both choices, if you like. What that looks like, I don't know.
And yeah, I know that in sort of, that might be an interesting question to pursue. I mean, it sounds like, if you're right, that I couldn't really entangle systems with two different time orientations, right?
Exactly.
Guess that something will forbid that, but a priori, that's not immediately obvious to me. So that's kind of what I'm thinking. Yeah,
I agree, and I think it's an interesting question. I have looked into the sort of generalized case, if you like, in algebraic quantum field theory, one fixes the structure to be sister algebras to start with, and I've heard that, yeah, there's some, I think the name escapes me now. I think some author in the past has like looked at trying to fix just the Jordan structure, but then, and I think a detailed analysis of that has not been done. I think it'll be interesting to pursue.
Yeah. This, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm next.
Seconds, you wanna
yeah. Okay, yeah, thanks for the talk. So I have a few questions. Let me start with this simple one, which is you're using a kind of logic that's very, very similar to sort of Gleason's theorem. Yeah. I mean, there's same kind of structure. And so I want to just start by saying, so if I wanted to know, you know, what are the valid quantum states on a pair, you know, on a Hilbert space, A tensor B, What would you say is deficient about just saying, well, I know what, I assume what the observables on A tensor B are, you know, that Hilbert space. It's just all, you know, all the projective valued measures on there. And then I use Gleason's theorem. And it's because it's a four-dimensional Hilbert space at the very least, Gleason's theorem is going to apply. And what do I get? I get all the positive bipartite quantum states. So to then say, oh, no, but I want to tie my hands behind my back and say, I don't know what the structure of the observables are. But I do know what the structures of the local observables are. Okay, you're still assuming a lot. You're assuming that the local observables are described by quantum mechanics. You're no longer describing that the composite is all projective value measures on the composite. But to some extent, it's not that different. You've already assumed part of quantum theory. All you've done is kind of handicap yourself a little bit more. So I guess I'm wondering how do you justify that kind of starting point?
Yeah. I guess the idea is really that, okay, like there is a physical constraint on the type of observables you can perform on a bipartite system, and fixing that to be given by quantum theory locally, one can argue that that is really just, okay, I don't know, if you do all possible measurements you can do in a lab, then you'll find that those are the ones that you have in quantum theory. So I mean, like In a way, actually, I'm assuming less, because I just use these behaviors, and I use Gleason's theorem to infer that this corresponds to the quantum structure. What I really just to quantum states. What I assume is just the types of measurements I can do and their commeasurability relations, right? So that's the sort of Gleason part that I assume. but I assume it locally. So I also have this physical constraint that I cannot perform arbitrary bipartite observables, which, yeah, like if there's an actual physical constraint, Alice and Bob being separated, they cannot, SpaceX separated, say.
I see.
But I mean, so your argument is totally correct, obviously, if I assume the full structure of observables.
Sure.
On the tensor product system, then Gleason's theorem tells me already that all possible behaviors correspond to quantum states.
Okay. So let me just ask a little bit more in this direction, which is, if you say, well, what are the possible measurements on a pair of qubits, for instance? There's a sense in which you might say, well, the kind of easy ones to implement are the ones that are tensor product form. But of course, if I precede any such measurement by a unitary that couples the two, then I can have an entangled basis measurement. And those are things I can go and do in the lab. I can do entangled basis measurements. That's, those measurements exist. So it seems to me the story has to be more something like you want to consider those measurements that can be done such that, the measurement starts and the systems are already spaced like separated and there's no opportunity to correlate them.
Yeah. That's true.
Okay. Good. So all right, let me move on. So I was trying to understand a little bit better your assumption of no disturbance on for dilations. Let me see if I'm on the right track in a way. So there's an old paper by Paul Bush where he says, look, Gleason's theorem is usually about assuming that your measurements are projective and figuring out what the state space must be. Let's allow, though, that the measurements, aren't necessarily projective, but they can be POVMs. There's some nuances about this, but roughly speaking, you could have done what Paul Bush did by just saying, let's grant that there's any POVM is a valid measurement. And then what you can prove is that, it's only the density operators, sort of same sort of Gleason type proof. But now you get it for dimension two in addition to dimension three and up. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you could do that by saying, well, let's not talk about the POVMs, but let's talk about dilations of those POVMs as projective measurements on larger Hilbert spaces. And if you did all of that, presumably you would also get a Gleason-type result, for dimension two. So I guess I'm curious if your no disturbance for dilations is analogous to assuming making Gleason's assumption for POVMs rather than just projective measurements.
That is an interesting question. So I haven't thought about that in particular. It is possible to extend. So here I always restrict it to dimension three, and I've used the sort of canonical version of Gleason's theorem. One can do this for two-dimensional systems also if one uses Bush's version. Right, but your question that, if one can think of this condition.
It might be helpful if you went back to your definition of no disturbance for dilations. Like, I've kind of forgotten.
Let me just jump. Yeah, this one. So the my first thought is that it's something different because I also have the Alice's system that I condition on, if you like, or that is dependent on context, and that's with respect to which I enforce non-contextuality conditions.
So maybe clarify for me what exactly is being dilated in this construction.
So yeah, again, I for every context, just say an Alice aside for now, I can think of this part of the map which maps projections on in this context and any projection on Bob's side. Into the unit interval, I can think of that as a positive operator value measure. So it maps the projections analysis side to the reduced state on Bob's side. But that will always, for now, like without enforcing any contextuality constraints on Alice's side, so this is always, this still depends on the on her context. I just get a collection of such POVMs indexed by these contexts. And the non-contextuality condition that I have with respect to these contexts, which is just the usual, well, these marginalization constraints, that allows me to lift this collection to a positive map. And what I do now is I dilate every single of these POVMs to a PVM.
Okay.
I can do that for every single one of them. There's no issue there. But then I enforce the non-contextuality constraints with respect to the PVM. So I ask that no disturbance holds with respect to these PVMs. So that's, I mean, that's the idea, and that's what this condition says.
It does, now that we've been through it, it really does feel similar in some respects to trying to run Gleason's theorem on a POVM, but sort of doing it by saying, well, every POVM can be more Neumark dilated to projective value measure. So I can sort of do it in the language of projectors once again, as long as I work in this larger Hilbert space. Now, and maybe I'm missing important details, but it feels similar in spirit.
Yeah, it does. Well, there seem to be two things again, like, because I mean, doing this first step here, say, so lifting these type of maps to one that maps into a positive operator here, that's sort of applying Gleason's theorem on Bob's side. And I've here assumed that HB is at least three-dimensional, so I can use standard Gleason, but I could also assume it to be two-dimensional and use Bush's version. So somehow this distinction already appears here without doing the second step. So somehow the two steps are definitely different. I'm not sure if it's still to do with the distinction that he makes. I would have to think about that more.
Your final results, they apply even for two qubits? Or do I need the three-dimensional Hilbert spaces on each side to have some sort of non-trivial context to work with?
You can apply it to two-dimensional systems, but then you have to use this, the version of Gleason's theorem by Bush that you reference. Here I've just used and in the paper also we've just used the canonical version of Gleason's theorem.
Okay, so then that case is your results would apply only if you have three tensor three.
Dimensional. Okay. It's a bit more natural in this formalism that I introduce here with these contexts to use the projective version, so Gleason's theorem original, but one can use Bush's theorem also.
So I don't want to dominate the question period, but I don't see anybody else with their hands up, so maybe I'll ask one more question and invite anybody else who has questions to just raise their hand. So my question is about the second half of your talk. I got a little bit lost when your final theorem is about characterization of separable bipartite states, but it felt that in the guts of the proof, you were relying strongly on how to represent partial transpose, and it seemed to me like you were talking about states with positive partial transpose, but because the separable states and the states with positive partial transpose only coincide in 2x2 and 2x3, those are different sets. So I kind of, I guess I got a little bit confused about why you were talking about states with positive partial transpose when you're trying to characterize the separable states. So maybe just take me through that again.
Yeah, okay. this was just to, I see where that might have been confusing. But the idea was just to relate it to the Paris-Wallis criterion, motivate why this is somehow similar in spirit. Where do I start? Yeah, it's in this slide. So here I just reformulate what the condition means for under the Chojo-Minkowski isomorphism. And then the first result was just to say that this criterion the Paracelsus criterion is empty for this larger class of states corresponding to composable maps. And I just used that as a motivation. I wanted to use that as a motivation for why the criterion is really to do with this distinction between Jordan's structure, which is precisely this difference between time orientations. But that was, yeah, it was more of a motivational result.
Okay, but it, let me just see if I understand. This proposition is basically saying when you're in this set S sub D,
yeah,
all states are PPT.
Exactly. Like in this, yeah, the corresponding notion of PPT, yeah, all states are PPT.
Okay, okay. And that gets used in your proof?
No, that doesn't get used in the proof. It just shows that this Jordan structure here it suggests that it's really the difference between the Jordan and C-star structure that the Paracelsus criterion uses. Because the Jordan part is like, that doesn't give you anything, like it's empty, the criterion for that part. So I just use that as a motivation. I wanted to use it as a motivation why, because the time orientations make that difference precise, right? Like that was the idea, like to lift a Jordan to a C-star algebra, it needs the structure that a time orientation encodes. So it just motivates the idea that separability has to do, or the Paracelsus criterion at this point has to do with precisely this difference. But yeah, this was more of a motivational result in that part of the final argument.
Okay, so this SD set, it does have entangled states. It's just that the PPT criterion, I mean, sort of like all the entangled states are PPT entangled. There's no NPT entangled states. And so
exactly,
you can't really talk about that boundary in this set, unlike for the full set.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, that helps. Thank you.
I wanted to just check my understanding about generalizing no signaling to the three-party case. We generally define no signaling as the inability of one party to signal to any other group. So that if we'd say like Alice cannot signal to Bob and Charlie working together, so that even if Bob's marginal doesn't change and Charlie's marginal doesn't change, no signaling is such that the joint distribution of Bob and Charlie cannot be different if it's just Alice who's considering a different setting. So in terms of what that would look like for measurements, we could imagine a measurement for Alice and then Bob and Charlie sort of working together, so that it doesn't necessarily at first value look like a product measurement. I'm wondering if if our goal is to sort of say like we want to capture no signaling, is positivity under tensor product really the appropriate notion when we go to three parties? Or do we want to say that it's more sort of positivity under any partition one versus two, which is a much broader set of measurements? But of course, then we need to define like what sort of measurements we're allowing for Alice and Bob, and no signaling doesn't require entangled measurements. It just says that if Alice doesn't measure and Bob doesn't measure, and Charlie doesn't measure, and then Bob and Charlie sort of figure out what the joint distribution is, even though they sort of did a product measurement, that shouldn't vary anything. So it seems to me that I just wanted to sort of confirm that positivity under tensor product with trace one guarantees no signaling even for the multi-party case.
I believe so. I lost you a bit on the last part. What was the exact question?
That if I tell you that we're performing product measurements, but we're allowing for any subgroup, strict subgroup of the parties to sort of collaborate and check their joint distribution, just
right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. then if all I know is that the operator is positive on tensor products, that is enough to ensure that the resulting correlations, even if they might not be quantum in the Trevor Project case, they will still be non-signaling in the strictest, like even two parties together can. Right.
Right. Yeah, I think so. Once, if you look at all bipartitions of the system, I would think yes. I'm not thinking so much, even though that would be an interesting direction to go to like generalize the classification of quantum states from the to multipartite case, like in the same sort of bottom up approach. The second part where I said I wanted to look at the multipartite case is more to do with sort of fixing already the Jordan structure and these decomposable states, and then just looking at this difference between how you choose these time orientations. So I think in that context, the question doesn't arise, but it's interesting to, yeah, I would have to look into that more detail. But I think, yeah, once you look at all bipartitions, then it should enforce no signaling.
Well, thank you again.